Welcome to Holding It Together, a joint production of Mennonite Church USA's Office of Women in Leadership and the Mennonite Inc. I'm Jenny Gastro. I'm so excited you found us. How do we, as women in leadership, navigate through expectations about our bodies imposed upon us by the white patriarchy embedded within our faith communities? What do we have to strip away? What do we have to let go of?
You cannot win at this game. And so I think as soon as we start to remember that, that gives us the opportunity to actually begin to come back to ourselves and start asking, you know, what does it mean to be me?
Today on Holding It Together, we continue our series on women in leadership with Melissa Flora Bixler, pastor of Raleigh Mennonite Church in North Carolina. She'll read Sexy Sexed Bodies in the Pulpit, Women's Bodily Negotiations. This essay is based on a presentation Melissa gave at the 2016 Women Doing Theology Conference and was published in January on the Minnow Snapshots blog.
In September 2016, the magazine Racked published an essay on the history of women's fashion trends, Power and Pockets. Chelsea Summers traces the lineage of pockets to the 17th century. At the time, both men and women's clothes included pockets in which to carry a variety of items discreetly, aiding freedom and subterfuge. Fashion changed with the French Revolution, when women's dresses began to pull closer to the body. Pockets were absent because they inhibited the line of the female form. Bags became necessary, putting women's necessities on display. So continued a trend in fashion history. Men's clothes adapted for the power of utility, while women's clothes adapted for visual effect. The less women could carry, the less freedom they had, writes Summers. Take away pockets happily hidden under garments, and you limit women's ability to navigate public spaces, to carry seditious or merely amorous writing, or to travel unaccompanied. Even as women's fashion began to incorporate pockets again, the fashion industry decried this innovation as masculine. In the 1890s, the New York Times quoted one sarcastic tailor as saying, "Not all women want to carry a revolver." Women's pocketless clothing was a sign of a version of feminine submission that refused to conceal the secretive, perhaps even the deadly. For Mennonite women, clothing choice is a particularly charged arena. I was in my 20s when the last woman in my church stopped wearing the head covering, a sign of nonconformity and of one's identity as a Christian Mennonite. But head coverings are also an emblem of female submission. In the history of our church, even as men were released from the restriction of the plain coat in public spaces, women continued to face pressure to wear distinctive clothing. Historian Beth Grable explains, "Women bear the burden of cultural separation on their bodies to a much greater extent than do men. These clothes reinforce to women that our bodies, without any intention of our own, are a source of sin. Our bodies act in spite of and against us." Just as women who took off the head covering began to unmask and unlearn ritualized forms of submission, I suspect we are at another juncture as Mennonite women. The massive fallout from the Me Too movement within 1 year of the election to the presidency of an accused sexual abuser, a man who jokes about assaulting women, is a reminder to all women that we are living in an age of unmasked misogyny. And in this moment, the voice of Audre Lorde echoes back to us, reminding us that women of today are still being called upon to stretch across the gap of male ignorance and to educate men as to our existence and our needs. This is an old and primary tool of all oppressors to keep the oppressed occupied with the master's concerns. Perhaps we are beginning to discover as Mennonite women that the time of respectability, the time of getting a foot in the door of patriarchal power, this time is over. The Chicana feminist Gloria Anzaldúa helps to understand the future as a form of disrobing from power. Anzaldúa begins an entry in her published journals dated May 1, 1980, addressed to Mujeres de Color, Companions in Writing. She writes, "I sit here naked in the sun, typewriter against my knee, trying to visualize you. Black women huddled over the desk in the fifth floor of some New York tenement, sitting on a porch in South Texas, a Chicana fanning away mosquitoes in the hot air. She goes on to write about the landscape for women writers of color. She talks about how it's unlikely for women of color to find friends in high literary places, how women of color will be accepted only when they scrape the dark off their faces. Anzal Dua writes naked, words unmasked, truth without any concern to be hidden, without the need to be clothed in the rules of domestication. She writes naked, taking off the one thing she can, stripping herself of the temptation to be taken seriously by white patriarchal institutions. She writes her words in solidarity with women who stand at those edges to which Lord points us. Stripping off takes other forms, forms of deep vulnerability embedded in protest. During the Liberian Women's Peace Movement, Lema Gabawi stripped naked as an act of protest. Later, reflecting on this act, she says, "If I'm being accused of obstructing justice and all I'm trying to do is deliver a semblance of justice to my people, I feel like there is no hope." It was an unbelievable depth of humiliation. So I said, "I'll make it easy for you. I'll strip naked." I was protesting the pain of every woman. When you're being raped, your clothes are torn off you. When you are protesting in pain, you are giving away the last shred of your integrity. And that is what I was doing in protest. Take what is left of womanhood for every Liberian woman. If this will be peace, bring peace, then take it. Constructs of femininity, our assumptions about how our culture has gendered our sex, have moralized virtues like modesty, submission, maternity, and meekness. Beth Grable observes that in plainclothes communities, if a woman were to exercise too much leadership or initiative, this is seen as a form of immodesty. A woman's style of leadership is directly linked to the way her body performs in public space. What do we need to strip away? I suspect that we will be working out the ways we are stripping ourselves down from cultures of white patriarchy, naming the power structures that have moored us to concerns we do not have time to pursue. It is becoming increasingly clear that there is no more time. Our collective life is at stake. Many of us are working out of old blueprints of expectation and response. Many of us continue to believe we can alter the structures, that if we are willing to endure one grope, one assault, one leering eye, that if we stand by while we are talked over and passed over, if we turn away from an abusive leader, if we play by the rules, we can effect change. Women of the Mennonite Church, I do not wish for you to be clothed in tyranny, to scrape by in conferences, churches, and denominational bodies that ask you to deny your bodies, your sexuality, your skin, your voice, your accent, your desire. Do not do it for me, for my well-being or my future. If you will be for me, come to this power stripped from all the respectability demanded of you. For all of us, speak loudly or softly. Let them adjust their hearing. Be abrasive or shy. Let go your attention to vocal fry and articulation, to skirt length and the sway of your hips and the pulpit. Denounce the stare and the tisk. Let your lips be bare or red. If they will not hear you or see you, kick the dust from your feet. If they will not have you as you are, know we are waiting here for you. If they will not have you, let them go their own way. Let them make a world without you, without us. We will make our own world.
So, Melissa, as a girl, what were you taught about your body? And how did that shape what you eventually came to believe about your body as a young adult or as an adult?
I think that most of my perceptions about my body actually came through church. I don't know that I heard any negative messaging at home. It felt very neutral, but I grew up in
conservative white evangelicalism. And as we all know, a big part of that culture is purity and chastity. And I think that part of what is behind those ways of being in the world are that there's something inherently dangerous about women's bodies in particular, that your body is always a threat, especially as you go through puberty. All of a sudden, your sort of understanding of your own body changes because you're getting some different kind of messaging about who you are. And I went on to an evangelical Christian college, Gordon College in Massachusetts. And at our college, there was this bulletin board called the Wittenberg Door that you could post like ideas, like provocative ideas. And at the time I was thinking, you should never give an 18-year-old full access to anonymously just putting things up for everyone to read. Now we have Facebook and people do that all the time. But at the time in 1998, it was sort of a, what are we doing? But frequently there would be comments about the way women dress on campus and people's skirts being too short, or, you know, women's breasts being on display. And so I think those messages continued to embed themselves in me for a long time. And it took a lot of healing from friends and from different communities I was a part of to come to peace with my body and to recognize that there's something insidious in those messages, that there's something we actually need to confront when we hear these message about the over-sexualization of our bodies as being something basic, essential to who we are as women.
And so you talk about that process of rejecting those messages that kind of seeped their way in, you said. And what was that process like? Friends, communities, what were those healing spaces for you? Where did you find those?
Yeah, I think communities of women have always been places where we have the opportunity to unpack those messages that we hear, but also the friendships that we have with books, with women who've come before us, who have shared their stories with us, and who've written love letters to us about who we are and about our bodies. And reading feminist theology was important to me, and getting to hear different beginning stories where feminists and womanists have interrogated some of the stories about Eve being responsible for the fall, right? Because that's where this begins. And then there's nakedness that is associated with sin and fallenness. And hearing those stories re-narrated to me as our bodies are redeemed as we come into the life of these communities and churches, and that we have opportunities to see ourselves as created good instead of as created as, again, essentially evil. All of that sort of unpacking happens over decades. I mean, I think it's something that takes us decades to undo within ourselves.
If it ever really becomes completely undone, right? It feels like it's a constant intention, mindset, like these messages that have seeped into my psyche, into the tapes in my head, to continue to say, this is the truth, mm-hmm. to name the truth. Yeah. It's a practice, like a spiritual practice almost.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the other part of that is also moving from being introduced to white feminist writers and then beginning to see how this becomes a more complicated story for me as a white woman as I encounter women of color writing about their experience of not seeing themselves on the covers of magazines and mm-hmm. not having access to makeup that that fits their skin color. And we read these reports now about how teachers understand Black girls' bodies as being more overtly sexual as five-year-olds than their white peers. And so also recognizing that within this narrative of confrontation for my own rehabilitation around stories about bodies is always to be aware that this is racialized too. And the racialized experience for me is different. And I have to be in solidarity in different ways and to begin to interrogate my own sort of participation in white patriarchal practices.
Did you expect, or could you have anticipated, a heightened focus on your body as you came into leadership in the church, as a pastor or even as a lay leader before you became a pastor? Did you anticipate the focus on your body?
Again, the community of women who have gone before us, they told me what to expect. And so I think I was pretty on alert by the time I got to pulpit ministry that my body communicated something in the pulpit that I didn't necessarily control. And so I think when I first began to ask some hard questions for myself about the limits of respectability, how much are you willing to adjust yourself and give up? And what are the costs of respectability? You know, women are always doing this, right? This cost benefit analysis, like how much are we willing to give up? And do I want to wear like a baggy suit every week to completely hide my body? Or, you know, just, or how much am I willing to lose of myself by trying to fit into the systems that are already here? And how much do you challenge them? And man, that is also just something you're always figuring out. There's no answer to that. It's just, you have to do it day by day, case by case.
So with that in mind, going into church leadership, how did you prepare? How did you prepare yourself in the face of those kinds of realities? And how did you prepare to respond to those kinds of named expectations?
A very practical thing that I do is I wear a uniform. I wear the same blue shirt and black pants every time I'm in the pulpit. And I know that for me, it has just been something that's helped me take away the questions that I associate with that, to delegitimize that as a space of power in my life. I just remember before I did this, I would spend so much time thinking like, is this too much cleavage? Is this button in the right place? Are these pants too tight? Is someone going to think I'm not feminine enough because I'm not wearing a dress, or like I shouldn't be wearing a dress? And it's just, it's exhausting. And I know some people have the energy to want to push back on that. And I just realized I didn't. And so it's funny, if anyone from my church listens to this, I don't know that they have ever even noticed. So I guess cat's out of the bag now, but it's so subconscious, right? And I think that if you just see someone wearing the same clothes every time, it just becomes less of a factor in your life. So I just felt like that I needed to protect my mental space. And there's just so many other things that are on my mind on Sunday morning that I just want to put that one aside. So that's been a really helpful and freeing in a lot of ways practice for me.
Your uniform is a way of rejecting what people would put upon you about expectations.
Yeah, I think that's right. It feels like taking back power from something that had a lot of power over me. I find that practice really helpful, and I recommend it to women who are feeling like they they don't know how to figure out those negotiations for themselves, just to try it for a little bit and see how it feels.
It reminds me of, just back to your essay, what you say so beautifully in this piece is that monitoring dress, the act of monitoring women's dress, and especially like in our context, women in leadership, women who speak from the pulpit, is just another form of white patriarchal oppression. Mm-hmm. And I think your act of wearing a uniform is like the act that you describe in your essay of stripping off. This is like the stripping off that Gloria Anzaldúa talks about and Lema Gawawi does. The external forces are attempting to force them to be a certain way, to do a certain thing. And they say, you know what? I'm not going to play this game.
Yeah.
Just like your uniform.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing when I was reading her journals to come across that phrase and to hear her reflections on that. You know, her struggles to try to make it in this world of white patriarchy in the academy for her, and reading Renee's reflections, and you know, it's her journals span a long period of time. So it's also great and highly recommend to everyone that you sort of see where she is in 10 years from those initial reflections. And she's so full, you know, you get the sense of just, she has found her place in the world and these community of people, and the people who needed her have found her. So that's what, you know, I I pulled out this other book that has been influential for me, Beyond Respectability by Brittany Cooper, because I think this also has helped me talk about these questions for myself. And Brittany Cooper's writing for women of color. And so I'm grateful to be able to listen in on this and to learn from it. But she says, if we actually want to take Black women seriously as thinkers and knowledge producers, we must begin to look for thinking in unexpected places. To expect its incursion in genres like autobiography, novels, news stories, medical records, organizational histories, public speeches, and diary entries. And I think reading that just reminded me that what I've learned from women of color who have always been at the margins of hegemonic power is creating this world. This world is already being created in places that are unexpected. And so to be able to carve out a different world, to say, like, we need to stop trying to make this world into our own world. I think I still struggle with those questions about the limits of respectability, because I also want to get things done, right? You know, like,
yes. That's always my question. Like, where do you know when to stop playing the game, right? And when it's just what you have to do.
Yeah. And I guess this is why we need each other, because I don't know that we can, you know, we need to be able to like help talk it through and like figure out what am I being asked to lay down of myself in order to take this step. In the long run, what are you actually gaining if you get there through the wrong means? If you get there by giving yourself up, what kind of world have you actually created? And is it a world that you want to be in to begin with? It's a world that comes into being through your sacrifice of who you are. You know, Jenny, I think you shared this with me. I really feel like something broke in me after the presidential election. It just felt like this opening up of the consequences of respectability in some ways. What are you willing to do to get by in the system? Like, you think that you can change these systems, and then we get somebody who brags about sexual assault and has 12 women accusing him of sexual assault. And people were just willing to sort of look past that as sort of as a form of saying, well, we just have to make these choices, right? Like at the end of the day, and to recognize just how much of a betrayal that felt to me, how much of a betrayal that felt to every woman of color I've spoken to about the election. I actually revised this essay. You remember the Women Doing Theology conference was right before the election. Mm-hmm. And then a few weeks later, I just had to go back to this and I took out some things that I had said about just ways we could make this work, make this system work. So the trauma of that is still very real for me. And I think this was some writing that helped me just begin to put some words to what is feeling like a deeper conviction within me about just having to create a new world for ourselves. I guess we just have to figure out how to do that together.
I really love the way you end it, challenging all of us to let go of respectability, let go of this idea of I'm going to play the game so that we can get to where we need to be. And the examples are just so beautiful and resonate so much with me, you know, like the talk about vocal fry, talk soft or loud, dress how you feel. I think Christian culture is so steeped in these values that you name, modesty, meekness, purity culture, shame around our physical bodies. There probably isn't a Christian woman who hasn't experienced the tension of self-expression versus, I'm using air quotes, Christian expectations. So in your everyday life and work, how do you resist?
I think it's so important for all of us to remember that we cannot win at that game, right? The Christian purity game. Like, you cannot win. There is nothing you can do to keep everybody happy. tries to remember, you know, you're not trying to wear a lot of makeup in the pulpit. And this was a couple years, you know, several years ago, at a different church. And I had someone come up to me and say, you should really wear lipstick in the pulpit because it's easier to see your mouth move. And I'm just thinking, like, you cannot win. You cannot win at this game. And so I think as soon as we start to remember that, that gives us the opportunity to actually begin to come back to ourselves and start asking, you know, what does it mean to be me? And to be a me with, of course, with that, you know, within the complications of power that cross gender lines and race lines, but to see that as an opportunity for self-discovery and communal discovery rather than a place of isolation. So I think that's just a mantra for us to say is we can't win this game. We need a new game. We need a new world. I also recognize, you know, that pastors especially, we have a lot of people in our world who struggle and people who need forms of care that require us to often do some dying to ourselves. And so I, you know, at the same time, this is where I, again, get into sort of those questions about the limits of respectability and, but, you know, also wanting to make a place for everybody in our church and our community. And so thinking about that as well. But I think at the end of the day, you know, here at Raleigh Mennonite, we want to cultivate a community where people can come fully as themselves. We don't just say that, but we embody it. And I think that starts with me up in the pulpit every week, sometimes with my four-year-old on my hip leading prayers or, yeah. So I think there's a lot of ways that we have to figure out how to do this in our individual circumstances and life, but that we need each other to help figure it out.
It's exciting to imagine a place where the question that everybody asks is, what does it mean to be me? And brings that expression of themselves. And where that's seen and accepted and celebrated.
Yeah, I was just remembering, I got to hear my friend Teresa Thames give her testimony about why she's still a Christian this week at the Why Christian Conference. And one of the things that she told me that I have experienced of her throughout years of friendship is how she reminds me that we can be many things at once. Because I think that's the other side of this, is that you can only be one thing. You can only be holy and you can only be pure. You're either an angry Black woman or you're a woman who's Black woman who's willing to work in the system. And it's actually, you can be all of those. You can be everything. And so, you know, Jenny, one of the things you often talk about is wanting to increase, like you talk about expansion and making circles that are bigger and bigger. And I think we also can do that for ourselves, that we can see ourselves as expanding, that we can be many things at once, and there can be so much that's happening within us. So we bring all of that with us. Full selves and the selves that we're still discovering in us or that are not yet developed, and that's okay too, that we're changing and we're growing and things drop off and things are added, and that all of that is welcome and needed in this new world that we want to have together.
It reminds me of just a line, and I don't even remember the writer or the poet, whoever said it, who said, I contain multitudes. And I think in within us, there's so much. Melissa, thanks so much for taking time to read your essay. Thank you for coming on and talking with us today.
Yeah, thanks, Jenny, for the opportunity.
A little footnote. The line from the poem that I quoted, that I couldn't remember the title or the author, it's from Walt Whitman's poem titled Song of Myself, a 52-part epic poem dedicated to the poet himself. His line is this: Do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. If you want to reread Melissa's essay, it can be found on the Minnow Snapshots blog at MennoniteUSA.org. Thanks again to Addie Lichty, whose original music was featured on the show today. To find more music by Addie, look for Addie and the Subtracts on Facebook or Addie Lichty on YouTube. Holding It Together is a joint production of Mennonite Church USA's Office of Women in Leadership and the Mennonite Inc. Look for us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Fireside, or wherever you prefer. And please tell your friends about the show. Thanks for listening, y'all. See you next time.
Just give another shout out for the next Women Doing Theology conference. If you can come, you should come. AMBS. Jenny, can you remind us of the date?
I think it's November 8 to 10, 2018.
If you are a guy listening to this podcast, maybe think about asking your church to send a woman on scholarship to Women Doing Theology. Because that's a place where some incredible work happens. Some good work, some hard work, some good work that is hard work. We do it all at once.